local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. The repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me wife, two kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. People, they used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the April 4th edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour. You are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on 90.1 FM WFT Radio for East Central Illinois and broadcasting worldwide at www.eft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Okay, we got a lot of good news stories today, and also we're going to be having a special, very special guest call in from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Greg Shotwell. Greg is a retired United Auto Workers member, and he's going to be talking a little bit about both the auto industry and a very critical issue for both the country at large and the auto industry in particular, single-payer health insurance. So, anyway, Bob?
And the underwriter this week, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice of labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide, recognizing that strong workers build strong communities. The AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Dave?
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. Now we'll go right to Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. In President Obama's speech on the plan to save the U.S. auto industry, there was not a word about protecting the pensions of more than a million workers or of guaranteeing their retiree health care, but there were threats of bankruptcy, albeit a structured bankruptcy that would keep GM and Chrysler in business. Obama says as GM cuts costs and goes after its workers for more sacrifice, he, the president, will somehow fight for auto workers.
I will fight for you. You're the reason I'm here today. I got my start fighting for working families in the shadows of a shuttered steel plant. I wake up every single day asking myself, what can I do to give you and working people all across this country a fair shot at the American dream?
For auto workers, he could start by protecting their pensions, their wages, their jobs, their retiree health care. The United Auto Workers Union won all of that for workers and more and delivered the American dream for generations of workers. But that was nowhere to be found in his speech. A senior administration official reiterated what the president said, that bankruptcy is a real possibility, though the administration says no decisions to go that route have been made. Despite labor costs comprising just 10% of the cost of a new car, all that's certain for auto workers is more pain and sacrifice. The United Auto Workers Union has already cut new hire wages in half, slashed other benefits, and is talking with GM and Chrysler now about taking billions of dollars less in cash to fund retiree health care. Obama says his administration is committed to the survival and viability of the U.S. auto industry, but no such commitment has been made to protect auto worker jobs, retiree pensions, or health care. The double standard of lavishing hundreds of billions of dollars on the financial industry while treating the auto industry and its workers much more harshly for much less in loans is stark. And Obama is not attaching any strings to the government's money that require that worker wages and benefits be restored if and when GM and Chrysler return to profitability. Workers are on the march in Connecticut, where union membership grew by 8% in 2008. The U.S. Department of Labor says organized labor in Connecticut grew by roughly 46,000 people. Overall, 16.9% of workers in Connecticut are in unions. Nationally, there was a small increase in overall union membership. The Blue-Green Alliance is backing comprehensive climate change legislation that would reduce carbon emissions by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. It's the first time that labor and environmental groups have joined in backing legislation like this. The Blue-Green Alliance consists of four unions and two environmental groups. The United Steelworkers' Leo Girard says that green legislation could actually put millions of Americans back to work to achieve climate change legislation goals of a greener America.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
While many state workers are sacrificing pay raises and submitting to wage freezes, or worse, being forced to take unpaid furloughs, federal workers may be about to get a 2.9% bump in their wages. The new budget being considered by Congress seeks the raise, which is 0.9% higher than the one proposed by President Barack Obama. The congressional proposal would make the non-military federal workers' raise equal to that of the one likely to be received by military personnel. According to the Office of Management and Budget Estimates, the increase would cost the government $1.3 billion. The 2.9% raise is already a cut for federal workers, who saw a raise of 3.9% this year. The last two pay raises, approved by the administration of George W. Bush, sought pay raise parity between military and non-military federal workers. 2 million workers have lost their jobs this year alone. Doug Cunningham files this report.
In March, another 663,000 people lost their jobs in America. The accelerating job losses pushed the official national unemployment rate to 8.5%, with no relief in sight. This is the highest unemployment U.S. workers have experienced since 1983. Since this recession started, 5.1 million jobs have been lost. The Center for Economic and Policy Research says we'll be really lucky if we stop losing jobs by the end of this year. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says this dire employment emergency calls for broad-based reforms to build sustained economic growth, and a second economic stimulus may well be needed. More than 3.2 million workers have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. More than 30 million Americans are on food stamps, according to the Food Research and Action Center. Despite a few mild signs of improvement in the economy, workers continue to be devastated by this recession.
We know that unemployment rates are on the rise, but who is being hit the hardest? According to the most recent report from the Economic Policy Institute, the jobless rate for African Americans is the highest at 13.1%. That's followed by Hispanics at 11.4%. As for specific industries, construction workers are the most likely to be jobless, with 21.1% of those workers unemployed. Teenagers are the most likely to be unemployed age group at 21.7%. On Friday, FedEx announced it would be cutting 1,000 jobs worldwide. The announcement comes 4 months after the company cut pay to salaried workers by 5%. 500 of the job cuts will come from the company's headquarters, and workers will be given first notice if positions reopen. The company additionally plans to cut hours and put in place a temporary hiring freeze.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Girl, I can't take you. Hey, I'm going to Detroit, Michigan. Girl, you got to stay here behind. Gonna get me a job on the Cadillac Assembly Line. I'm tired of hooping and hollering down the Mississippi Road. Hey, I'm tired of hooping and picking that nasty cut. Gonna bust up now. I have to keep saying yes to ball.
Okay, that was Albert King singing Cadillac Assembly Line. We're going to be playing some auto-related music today in honor of our guest calling in. But anyway, first, I think we want to do a few public service announcements here. Tom Thomas is not on the program today. Bob Pelezzi and myself are doing a duet today.
The best we can without him.
Yes, indeed. So we're still going to play his theme music, though, for the public service announcements. Anyway, today at 2 p.m. to 4 is the local AWARE anti-war rally, and that's going to be on the corner of Main and Neal. That's from 2 to 4 p.m. today. And remember, folks, the war is still not over in Iraq, regardless of what you hear, and it's going to be escalating in Afghanistan, so it's important we turn out and show that we are opposed to war.
And there is a march today, a student solidarity with labor rally, and that is happening at Green and Wright at the Alma Mater at 12:30 p.m. today. And this is, you can join the UIUC students as they show their support for working people. They support the immediate implementation and enforcement of the Vendor Code of Conduct by President White, the Employee Free Choice Act, the GEO as they enter into contract negotiation with the university, and all UIUC clerical, building, and food service workers. And that's at the corner of Green and Wright at the Alma Mater Stature at 12:30 today.
Okay. Also, tomorrow on Urbana Public Television from 4 to 5 p.m., tune in and hear Labor's NC, Labor's View, the Labor Television program with your hosts David Johnson and Jim Iman. This Sunday's program from 4 to 5 will cover the Great Strike of 1877, and we'll be doing some commentary, some historical data as well, as we're going to be showing a 30-minute DVD about the Great Strike of 1877 called The Grand Army of Starvation, which is narrated by James Earl Jones. Also tomorrow at the Independent Media Center at 202 South Broadway, downtown Urbana Post Office, will be a People's Potluck. These are the monthly People's Potlucks, the first Sunday of the month, and that's going to be from 6 to 8, and all are welcome. And this is going to be leading up, of course, to the Saturday, May 2nd, Central Illinois Social Forum with lots of out-of-town guests. They're going to be having workshops on anti-eviction home foreclosure, various other workshops as well as for in mutual aid and support networks and people empowerment. And there's also going to be the showing of the film The Take about the Argentinian, after the collapse of the Argentinian economy and the workers taking over the factories. And there's also going to be musical entertainment, and that's going to be going from 1 p.m. to midnight on Saturday, May 2nd. So all are welcome. Turn out and learn some various skills on surviving in this economic hard times and meet some great people there. Also, I want to add, Paul?
The one main event is mainly not on Main anymore. You announced the demonstration by Aware. It's actually State
Paul,
University.
I just got a note from Mick that somebody called in.
Oh, well.
It's on, it's
on
Main and Neal. Yes, I did.
I was looking it up while you were announcing it.
Yeah, it's on Main and Neal.
Okay.
But thanks anyway.
No, not Main and Neal.
This is what Mick just sent me an email.
Well, I just checked the the Aware website, and I believe Dave Green also announced that it's on the southeast corner of the park. So it's University and State.
Okay. Well, I guess if people show up at either place,
walk around. It's going to be a nice day for
check both places.
Take a stroll.
There's only two blocks away, so either Main and Neal or State University. Thanks, Paul. Okay, and let's see here. One last little announcement here is that. After 500 mountains in Appalachia have been blown to bits by mountaintop removal, one peak was most likely saved today, Blair Mountain in West Virginia. The site of the largest armed insurrection in the United States since the Civil War was officially approved by the Keeper of the National Register of Historic Places to be placed on the National Register. And there's a DVD you can go, actually a posting, which has a little, DVD there at HuffingtonPost.com. And the title of it is A Big Coal Defeat, Rednecks and Greens Announce Victory at Blair Mountain. So you can check that out. And Bob, there's a... Yes, Paul?
Stuart called in, and he's updating the website right now.
Okay, so where's
the call
location?
In earlier is right. It's Main. It's back at 1 Main.
Main and Neal.
Because the road is open. The building has been demolished. And
okay.
It's a good image of destruction to look at, I guess. let's imagine that we're in Baghdad.
Oh, I don't know if I want to do that, but yes, it's a. I guess it would be an appropriate symbol. Okay, and Bob, today's a certain historical date of note. What is that?
April 4th would be the 41st anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King being shot in Memphis.
And that was 1968 then?
1968, mm-hmm. And he was there supporting the garbage workers that were on strike. Is that correct,
Dave? That's right. That's correct, yeah. Also, it's interesting, it's the 42nd anniversary, a year to the day, before he was assassinated, murdered, he did the famous Riverside speech against the Vietnam War, and basically calling to question the whole corporate imperialist model of the United States foreign policy, which if you hear the speech or go read the text, it's as relevant today as it was 42 years ago. It's eerie. So, yes. Okay, well... very good. Then I guess we've got quite a few news stories here today, and we're going to be going over some of these until our guest calls in. And Bob, what do you have for us today?
I've got a story about IBM, and when somebody first sent this to me this week, I kind of thought it was an April Fool's joke, but apparently it's not. It says, leave it to a corporation to think of a way to put a patent on offshoring. IBM just filed a patent for a software package that will help companies to move their businesses overseas. All that's necessary to run the software is to plug in a few numbers, and it will crunch out information that shows how to maximize profits by hiring the lowest cost global resource pools while getting the biggest government tax breaks. Firing thousands of American employees and moving entire industries to other countries becomes nothing more than a mathematical model. IBM's expertise on offshoring jobs comes from years of experience and a proven reputation. They might even be using beta versions of their new software to implement their recent round of layoffs, although they haven't admitted to doing so. For IBM itself, the patent filing couldn't be any timelier. The company submitted the application to a U.S. Patent and Trademark Office last Thursday, the same day it confirmed that it is eliminating more jobs in its North American operations. And they apparently eliminated about 5,000 workers this week. It says here, in short, IBM is attempting to reduce offshoring considerations to a mathematical model, or in the words of the application, a robust and reusable sourcing template for identifying and analyzing global resource pools. Now, the next day, IBM came out and withdrew its patent application, calling it an error.
But okay.
This is all after a story that we reported on here about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, and that was under a program called Project Match. IBM will help laid off workers from domestic sites obtain travel and visa assistance for countries in which Big Blue has openings. Mostly that's developing markets like India, China, and Brazil. And they were helping employees get visas and things like that. The catch was that wages in the country are pennies on the dollar compared to U.S. salaries.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, indeed. And in fact, you know, the whole issue here is exploitation of labor.
Yes, it is.
You know, one thing they use a lot for both high-tech and engineering jobs, as well as even jobs in the construction industry, is that they'll import workers from low-wage countries under the HB1 visa program, in which these workers are paid a fourth or less of what an American would get for the same position. And this is ridiculous because they should, if they're going to import some worker from another country, they need to be earning the same thing of what a comparable position, you know, what an American would get for the same position. Okay. Not only that, but they're basically created, they're made an indentured servant under this HB1 visa program because if they don't like their employment for some reason and they want to quit or they get fired, then they, under the terms of the, under the conditions of the visa, they have only a short period of time to immediately leave the country. It gives them no time to look for another job or anything else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just it's a modern form of indentured servitude that's driving down the standard of living, the wages of American workers. And this is happening to a little bit lesser degree in Europe. But anyway, speaking of Europe, the phenomena of fired workers occupying factories returned to the British Isles on Wednesdays as workers occupied three plants owned by the collapsed UK arm of Visteon, the struggling US car parts supplier. The protests mark an escalation in workers' reaction to job losses in an ever tighter labor market and fresh headache for Ford Motor, Visteon's biggest customer. Workers are demanding that the Detroit carmaker, which spun off Visteon in 2007, grant them severance payments. According to KPMG, the professional services firm and Visteon's UK receiver, 100 workers occupied its Belfast plant overnight from Tuesday. Smaller numbers joined them at Visteon's other two sites on Wednesday, staging a sit-in in Basildon, Essex, and gathering on the roof in Enfield, north of London. Visteon and Unite, the trade union, gave differing figures for the number of employees involved, which both said was fluctuating because of the shift changes. The workers' demand stemmed from Visteon's split from Ford when employees were given contracts and benefits mirroring the car makers. Unite on Wednesday claimed these included 12 to 18-month wages. It said Ford would pay workers in the event of a plant closing rather than the small statutory payments being offered. Ford has ruled out bailout of Visteon, whose U.S. auditors recently questioned its viability as a going concern. concern. Ford UK said, quote, Ford is not in a position to fund insolvent suppliers. The sit-ins were rare in Britain until recently, and this is, happens all the time, I guess, evidently in France and other parts of Europe on the continent. But this is, I think, just a sign of the times of the downturn in the worldwide economy.
Yeah, Dave, I got a story here about two more teachers being murdered in Colombia. Ramiro Cuadros Robalo and Walter Escobar Marin, both members of SUTEV, a teachers union, and two other trade unionists were assassinated last month as the violence against trade unionists continues to mount. Ramiro Cuadros Robalo worked for 20 years as a teacher and was a prominent union leader. In recent years, he assisted teachers in their claims for debt payments at the local administration of Tuluá in the department of Valle de Cuaca. Due to his work in the defense and promotion of trade union and human rights, he received many death threats over a period of several years, peaking at the end of 2008. And on the 24th of March at 6 a.m., he was shot dead outside his house by a group of gunmen as he set off for work. And Walter Escobar Marin worked at an educational institution in the district of Cali. And the circumstances of his death remain unknown since his body was found in the district of Palmira on the 21st of March after a reported absence at work of 8 days. And also in Colombia, Colombian coal trains have stopped due to a labor strike. Thousands of tons of coal from Colombian mines is being stopped from getting to port due to a railway worker strike. Some 600 employees at the Finoco transportation firm have called a work stoppage to demand recognition of their labor union. The strike has stopped 130,000 tons of coal per day from being transported to Caribbean ports from northern Colombian mines. When Finoco comes around to recognizing the union and is willing to sit down and negotiate with us, we'll lift the strike.
Okay, I think our guest is calling in.
All right, sounds good.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, David. This is Greg Shotwell.
Hi, Greg. Welcome to the program. I'm glad that you were able to call in today and everything. I want to just first kind of introduce you to all of our listeners. We have Greg Shotwell on the phone, who lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's retired from General Motors. He retired from General Motors in 2008 after 30 years of work. He's worked at three different GM plants, including a stint at Delphi. He's co-founder of Soldiers of Solidarity, a dissident group of UAW members who sprang out of the conflict with Delphi over bankruptcy in 2005. Soldiers of Solidarity members believe that the fundamental principles of unionism, rather than union management cooperation, will better serve the membership and the community at large. Greg writes an online column, Live Bait and Ammo, which is widely distributed on shop floors throughout the United Auto Workers, and the full collection can be read at soldiersofsolidarity.com. One of Greg's primary concerns is a two-tier trend in America whereby young workers are compensated at lower rates than older workers. He believes the two-tier system is socially decadent and is spreading into other areas of life like health care. Next week, Greg and his wife Sheila will attend the Juke Joint Festival in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is home of the Crossroads, where the notorious blues guitarist Robert Johnson sold his soul for a legendary talent musicians are still drawing from. From there, he will go on to Civil Rights Tour of Mississippi and Alabama. In May, Greg expects to participate in a Labor Notes Conference workshop in Chicago on Work to Rule, a shop floor tactic of direct action that empowers workers at the point of production. Okay, well, Greg, again, welcome to the show, and that was a really great bio you provided me. Where do you want to start?
Well, we need my area of experience is the UAW and the auto industry, and I kind of want to stick with that and the crisis that we're seeing today.
Okay.
Did you have a question?
Well, sure. What do you think of the latest Obama's administration's proposal for the auto industry?
Well, it's what's really disappointing is that we didn't see investment. For the government to provide so much backing, and this isn't the way they're providing these company loans, but nonetheless, they are providing them more money than the company's worth, and that they could buy the whole company at this point. What we really need, and not just what auto workers need, not what the corporations need, but what America needs is investment in manufacturing. Because this isn't just about General Motors and Chrysler. It's not just about the UAW. It's about everyone. it's about all workers, because this is going to have a big impact on employment in the United States and wages in the United States, compensation in the United States. It would have been really helpful if there had been an investment into products that would confront the dual challenge of environmental crisis and energy independence.
Mm-hmm.
If they had said, we need to build products to help us become more energy independent, like China. Now, China isn't hesitating to do this. They are investing long-term in research and development, production, and consumption of electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the United States in
this? I don't know if you're... Yes, go ahead.
It's not enough to invest in the research and development, because we know when General Motors or Chrysler or Ford comes out with an all-electric vehicle, it's going to be too expensive. Most people won't be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be profitable in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So there would also need to be a government subsidy for consumption. But in the long term, this would put the United States, put manufacturing on the cutting edge of this development. But also, how is it that the government can provide so much money and yet be demanding that the companies downsize, close plants, and lay off workers? This is counterproductive.
Oh, indeed, and it's also quite hypocritical considering, they've turned over, $10 trillion, handed over to the banks and the hedge funds so far, with basically no strings attached, no conditions, no transparency, but yet they expect, auto workers to make, the auto workers themselves to make massive concessions.
And this is part of, my concern about two-tier, and I think this is becoming really evident to people now that we have class conflict in the United States.
Indeed.
That was something that I think Americans in general did not want to admit, and now it's in their face and they can't deny it, that the bankers and people who work in that service are not treated the same as blue-collar workers. Well, when I'm talking about two-tier, and I think one of the things that's very insidious about it is, originally we saw this in collective bargaining agreements, where the new worker coming in was given a wage cut, and so that the older worker was protected and they didn't have to make any sacrifices. One of the insidious things about this was these new workers weren't permitted to vote. This was the union's cowardice in this whole thing. And we're seeing this spreading. They're protecting the older worker, or they're protecting the upper classes, but the new workers coming in, the younger people, are not only going to take a wage cut, but they're going to be expected to pay more. For example, in healthcare, the Obama administration right now is promoting a healthcare plan whereby private insurance would continue to operate side by side with a government program like Medicare. But people would be mandated to buy insurance. So, they may subsidize people who are poor. But if you're working, you'll be mandated to buy health insurance. Does that mean you won't have to pay Medicare insurance anymore?
Yeah, probably not.
No, they're going to pay Medicare insurance. They'll be paying taxes for Medicare and Social Security, and then they'll be mandated to buy insurance on top of it. And on top of that, their wages are going to be cut. And then we get into this thrift paradox, where when you cut the wages, you're going to hurt the economy, because these people not only won't be able to afford to buy homes and cars, they're not going to be able to save money themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, this is, to me, it's really obscene. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, not just in context with all the money that's been handed over to the financial industry, but, you know, it's, you guys, I mean, what, for the last 10 years or more have been making concessions both on the job cuts as well as, you know, wages and benefits. I mean, I don't ever remember, you know, this ever being imposed on the financial industry in any way. And also, you know, we need an auto industry, and I don't know if you've ever seen the film Who Killed the Electric Car or not.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, this it's obvious. I mean, this basically was, what, 15 or more years ago when they had that prototype out in California they leased to people. And, I mean, just think if, you know, if they had been actually putting money into research and development all this time, that we could have had a really excellent electric car that would be available to consumers out there.
Yeah. General Motors, you know, management really lost an opportunity, and they were making that electric car in Lansing. I worked in Lansing. I live in Grand Rapids. It was like a 140-mile round trip. But if I'd had an electric vehicle, I could have left in the morning, drove to work, plugged it in at work, drove it home, spent zero money on gas, and not emitted any, you know, pollution.
Mm-hmm.
On top of it, but they had this opportunity, and they really blew it. Which, you know, when you don't have any manufacturing in the country, and I think this is really what it's about. Not none of this automotive provide a lot of jobs because there's so many components that go into a car, so many materials,
mm-hmm.
Plastic, steel, copper, you know, electronics. So now it provides a lot of jobs, but it's about research, development, and it's about skills. We are losing the culture of tool making
mm-hmm.
in the United States. Tool makers, you can go to school and learn about tool making, but really it's a skill that is passed from one person to another. And you go a generation without tool makers, and you will have lost that skill, that it's more than a knowledge.
Yes,
not,
indeed.
Not something that can simply be learned in books. And so this will also impede our ability to develop new products,
mm-hmm.
Because that won't be in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when they attribute, when labor is about 10% of the cost of the vehicle, but the conservatives in the country, the financial advisors, these wizards, attribute about 90% of the losses to us.
Okay. That doesn't quite make sense mathematically to me.
No, it doesn't, but they don't seem to have a problem with that.
No, they're, you know, they're liars anyway, so...
Well, you know, that's becoming more evident, but mm-hmm. they get away with this because they're dominating the major media, especially, you know, the business section,
mm-hmm.
The analysis. And mm-hmm. we don't have, in the UAW, a public relations department that is really defending American workers.
Well, speaking of the UAW, it doesn't sound like your union leadership has been doing a very good job in the last 10 years. You know, historically, we see these old film footage from the 1930s with the Flint sit-down strike and all the other actions that got, you know, basically got the recognition for the United Auto Workers. And man, oh man, something definitely happened between the late end of the Second World War and it seemed like the 1990s or so. What happened,
well,
do you think?
You know, really, it was, you know, it began in the 1980s when the UAW decided to cooperate with management. They, leadership at least, felt that it was best to drop the adversarial approach
mm-hmm.
and to become partners in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, all we've seen is a drop in UAW membership. And it hasn't apparently made the company any more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got some statistics here, and I got this from General Motors' annual reports. I'm not just pulling this out of my hat. But,
mm-hmm.
In you know, they always complain that we have to make concessions because they're losing market share. The market share has gone down because the market got so much bigger. But here's the facts. In 1992, General Motors sold worldwide 4.4 million vehicles. In 2005, this is 13 years later, they lost market share but they sold 4.5 million vehicles. In 2007, they lost market share again, but they sold 4.5 million vehicles. Now, this 4.5 million vehicles, this is in, I'm talking North America, mm-hmm. just in the United States. Go back to 1992, 4.4 million vehicles, there were 265,000 UAW members at General Motors. In 2005, there were 111,000. And in 2007, there were 73,000.
Mm. Well,
so they produced the same amount of vehicles with less than half the members. Productivity has jumped right off the charts. I don't even know how to measure that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you attribute loss to UAW members when they're producing the same amount of vehicles with a third of the workers?
Indeed. But it's funny, we don't hear any of that on CNN or Fox or PBS. I mean, that just seems to be a conveniently unmentioned fact.
So much is conveniently unmentioned, but you may recall in 2008, General Motors said we lost $39 billion due to an accounting change on future deferred tax credits. What the hell does that mean?
Well, good question. That was going to be my next question.
I think you and I need to figure out how we can claim losses on our income tax due to future deferred taxes
mm-hmm.
and, some accounting change. What we do know is that this has nothing whatsoever to do with labor. Labor cannot be attributed to that kind of a loss.
Yeah, and also on top of that, which I was not aware of, is, this ties in, too, with what you mentioned about the new hire, younger workers being, hired in a lower wage scale and it more paying more for benefits, and not to mention the outrageous act of them not being able to vote in the union. Then there's the thing about the retirees. I mean, as far as their pension and health insurance, they're talking about basically just eliminating totally. And that was supposed to be, funded to where these people would have a pension and health care for life. What happened to that money?
That's a very good question, because I earned this when I was actually working.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for 30 years for this health care and this retirement, and I earned it. It's just like I paid off on my mortgage,
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've paid it off, they want to take it back. When I was working, that money should have been set aside in a trust fund. But the way the law works in the United States, there's certain laws regulating the pension fund, but not the health care.
Okay.
So they never did set aside it. All they did is set aside the money for the health care. They only made a promise. And so that debt is unsecured.
Oh,
and in bankruptcy, they do not have a legal obligation. Now, when someone has an ethical obligation but not a legal obligation, you'll find that they're going to, suppress their guilt by blaming you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, we're hearing so much in the business press, that it's our fault that General Motors is being dragged down. Now, and this is very short-sighted history, between 1994 and 2003, General Motors made $104 billion profit. Not only did they make this profit, but all during this time, when North American operations were profitable, they were taking, profits made here and investing overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Very broadly in Eastern Europe, in Brazil, in China,
mm-hmm.
Thailand.
All low-wage countries.
Right. Now, all low-wage countries. But those assets were generated by labor in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In North America.
And what percentage of a typical American car anymore is actually made in the United States?
Well, if that's a concern for you as a consumer when you buy a car, you might want to question that and look more closely. A lot of General Motors and Ford cars are not even assembled in the United States. And they a lot of the parts now are coming from outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a very large supplier base, in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
there's still a lot of auto workers in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the UAW failed to organize because they became a business union rather than an organizing union.
Mm-hmm.
And as a business union, they took it in their position to be partners with the company.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they have a very corporatist worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was bringing the thing about the percentage of the American vehicle made actually in the United States by American workers, not as a form of national chauvinism, if you will, but trying to point out more money the corporations making at the expense of workers. I mean, you know, I would have no problem necessarily with a worker making components like, say, in Brazil or China if they were paid the same as an American worker. But, of course, if that was the case, they wouldn't have production facilities in Brazil or China. So, I mean, this is the whole point is how much that money is actually going to the worker who builds the car and how much is going into the pockets of the corporate managers and the shareholders.
Well, the other thing is, this is part of a long-term strategy. You know, my friend Dave Yetta, God bless him, he's passed away, but he used to say that the company is playing chess and the UAW is playing checkers. The company
yeah.
is always thinking, you know, 3-4 moves in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what they see... People right now, they're blaming General Motors. They say, well, you're not building these fuel-efficient vehicles. Well, yes, they are. They're building them in Europe. They're building them in China. They're building them in South America. They have the technology, and it's ready to go. They want to become an importer to the United States, just like Toyota. See, Toyota, they say, well, they build Toyotas in the United States. Indeed, they do, but about 50% of the cars that they sell in the United States are made outside the United States in countries that provide national health insurance.
Mm-hmm. That was going to be my next lead-in, if you will. That seems to be a very critical issue, not just for the country at large, but for, in particular, the auto industry, because you mentioned that this actually creates a disadvantage for U.S. automakers compared to, like, say, the Europeans.
You know, to me, and this is what another disappointment about current negotiations between the administration and the auto companies and the UAW. The UAW is angling for the administration to subsidize health care for retirees. In other words, they have set up this VIBA, this trust fund, that will be run by the union, and it's going to be funded with company stock, which puts the union in a conflict of interest immediately.
Indeed.
But they also want the government to back it. Well, what UAW is, again, bargaining for privileged for a select few. This is not an answer for the economy. All manufacturing in the United States is at a tremendous disadvantage because of health care.
Mm-hmm.
All Americans, employers, consumers, would have would be in a better position if we had single-payer universal health care, like our competitors overseas.
Yeah, and even Canada. Every industrialized country in the world except the United States, and even some third-world countries have national single-payer health care.
Yes, yes. It's the single most important disadvantage that we have and that we could, we could clearly do. And we would like the United Auto Workers to take the forefront in pressuring the government and the companies to support this.
Mm-hmm.
By putting themselves on the line. Let's put ourselves... All right, I am a retiree, and I'm really dependent now. I'm not old enough for Medicare, so I'm really dependent on health care from General Motors and the success of this VIBA. But I don't want, to have this privilege over somebody else. I don't want to feel part of this two-tier where I get mine and then the other manufacturers and people working at the suppliers don't get theirs. In fact, the people that I left behind, the new hires coming in behind me at General Motors, don't have health care and retirement. Why should I have it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a...
Not them.
That's a very good point. Okay, a couple last things to finish up here. What do you think about the all the worker occupations going on in Europe?
That's an envy for a lot of us to see that sort of radical response,
mm-hmm.
if you will. I only hope that it can spread, because most of the occupations we've seen, even the one we saw in Chicago, were about severance.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, we got to say it's about job ownership.
Indeed, indeed.
No, we need to make the leap from, we want you to pay us with the severance that we have to us, and that is justified to say, we're not going to close this plant, we're going to run this plant.
Indeed.
We're going to keep it open.
There's my solution to the auto industry, is basically have the government take it over, nationalize it like they did AIG, but turn it over to the workers. Everyone from the assembly line worker to the engineers and the designers. Then I'd like to see how well the company would be run.
Well, you know, I think most Americans don't trust that the government knows how to do that. They just don't have that kind of faith in our government,
mm-hmm.
and for good reason.
Well,
the government has failed. But if they were at least willing to invest in development of these products and turn more of that control over to the people who know. See, General Motors, you know, is being run by financiers. It's not being run by engineers or people who
that's
really
right.
mm-hmm. know about cars.
Mm-hmm.
But there's you know, this crisis is giving us some, it's opening people's eyes, giving us some opportunity, you know, to make some significant changes. And, you know, one of the things that I've, you know, been promoting for years is work to rule. It's about putting power into workers' hands where they most experience it, which is, you know, they spend most of their lives on the job.
Yes.
And I think, you know, Sam Ginden, the Canadian auto workers economist, actually, said if workers don't experience some power on the job, some democracy in the workplace, they're not going to feel that they have, you know, any power, any hope outside of the workplace.
Well, that's a good, very good point. And when are you going to be in Chicago for Labor Notes?
You know, they haven't set the date yet, but it's in May.
In May?
And, yes, it'll be like either the 9th or the 16th, I believe.
Okay, and, well, definitely we'll let our listeners know as soon as we can about when that's going to happen, and I'm going to try to make it up. We've met a couple times in the past and everything, and always enjoy talking to you, Greg, and please, you know, let us know when that, you send me an email about that Labor Notes as soon as you hear the date, and we'll get it out, word out and stuff, and I look forward to maybe seeing you up in Chicago.
Okay, thanks a lot,
well,
David.
Good talking to you. Yes, thanks for calling in. Goodbye. You just heard Jimmy Thackeray, and that was Mercury Blues. And we've got a few news stories we'd like to get out here before the end of our program. And Bob?
Yes, Dave, the U.S. unemployment rate soared to 8.5% last month, a 25-year high, as employers slashed jobs and cut workers' hours to the lowest level on record. In a report underscoring the economy's distress, the Labor Department said employers slashed 663,000 jobs in March and revised prior data to show job losses of 741,000 in January, the biggest decline since October of 1949. And that's just the figure that they quote generally. There's also what they call the U6 unemployment rate, or what people refer to as the real unemployment rate. And the Labor Department's broadest measure of unemployment rates reached a stunning 15.6% in March. That was up from 14.8%. And that includes two other groups of people, marginally attached workers, defined as people who currently are neither working nor looking for work, but indicate that they want and are available for a job and have looked for work sometime in the past, and also persons employed part-time for economic reasons, where they would be wanting full-time work, but they've had to settle for a part-time schedule. So,
okay. And just a few minutes left here, I want to mention that we covered that story early on Ford Visteon's plant, the factory occupation in Belfast. Well, there's some, just to kind of run down some of the factory occupations that have been occurring here recently. In Northern Ireland, fired workers at Waterford Crystal occupied the world-renowned glassmaking factory after it was shut down. The occupation was started in late January, ended after almost 2 months with the announcement that 176 jobs have been saved for at least 6 months. In Dundee, Scotland, staff at Prism, a box manufacturer, are in their fifth week of an occupation and are reportedly planning to restart the business as a workers' cooperative. Yay, way to go. And in France, workers at Caterpillar took the dramatic step Tuesday of kidnapping four managers who were held for 24 hours at the company's plant in the southeastern city of Grenoble before being released Wednesday. Workers were angry that 700 of the 2,500 employees faced layoff due to a drop in demand for Caterpillar bulldozers. The action at Caterpillar was the fourth boss snapping in France in the last month. Last week, workers at 3M held executive Lou Rosset overnight until management agreed to discuss job cuts with staff. The chief executive and director of human relations of Sony's French arm was also held for a day by workers, and two managers were locked up at Kleber Michelin machine parts factory in Toul. Holding management overnight is an extreme, though not entirely uncommon tactic in French industrial disputes that first rose to prominence during the 1968 revolt by students and workers. Traditionally, workers have entered into discussion with employers over job losses and other hot button issues like pay and benefits. The discussions failed. There was always the nuclear option, a strike. With workers being laid off, strikes are not possible, thus the more extreme measures. And
Dave, I've heard that the police stand by and let these things happen. They don't intervene at all, and that the workers take real good care of these bosses. In fact, they bring them in like 5-course meals to eat for dinner and stuff. So,
well, gee, I don't know if I would agree with that. If I was occupying the factory and held them, they'd be getting bologna sandwiches and
like
you get in the county jail. Not that I know, just from hearing from what other people have said. But
I'm just telling you that they treat the bosses pretty well.
Well, I disagree with that policy, but everything else I would have to absolutely agree with. And that's the thing is that, see, in Europe and in South America, most countries in South America, this is accepted as a normal part of industrial relations.
Right.
Here, if this happened, they would send in the SWAT team,
yes,
and probably charge these workers under terrorism laws. Well, of course, the only way you're going to be able to fight that is basically have such a widespread series of factory occupations that they can't, it'd make it politically impossible for them to charge people under terrorism charges, and I wouldn't be able to lock everybody up. And, you know, I'm wondering, when are the American workers going to start fighting back like they have in other parts of the world? And by gosh, I mean, how far are we going to let the corporate America push us down? I mean, we're going to go, they're going to push us down to levels that we experienced in the 19th century or even the 1930s, near barely subsistence or even close to starvation levels. We shouldn't allow that to happen. So anyway, next, stay tuned for Bard 2 Verse.